Jim, you want to start?
I'm Jim Hanneke, Assistant Commissioner with Rehabilitation Services.
I'm Steve Ashmo, the Promoting Independence Office of Department of Aging and Disability Services.
Got it.
Nick Doster, Director of Governmental Affairs, Department of State Health Services.
Got you guys out of the office, so. Good time.
Kelly Sprunis, Consumer with the Mary Lee Foundation.
With?
The Mary Lee Foundation.
Mary Lee, yeah. Know it very well. Good.
Sherry Gothard, Bearin, Texas Department of Agriculture.
Hi, me.
Good afternoon. Paige McGilloway. I'm with the Texas State Affordable Housing Corporation.
Oh, excellent.
I'm David Dennis, Texas State.
Kate Moore with the Texas Department of Housing.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. Elizabeth Yavich, also with the Department of Housing.
Great. Oh, perfect. Excellent. All right, and who do we have on the phone?
Could those on the phone introduce themselves?
Kenneth Darden, Governor Appointee, Minority Representative.
Mike Goodwin, Governor Appointee, Housing Developer.
Gene Langendorf, Governor Appointee, Rural.
Donnie Van Rysdyk, Governor Appointee, Promoting Independence Advisory.
Okay, great. And can you hear me okay on the phone?
Yes.
All clear.
We've got a little, you know, New York accent going there, but I'll do the best I can. So, yeah, you're
Long Island boy here.
Oh, good, good. I think what this is, it was just like, is you guys and we lost out on the Cliff League sweepstakes.
Yeah. So
you lost revenue, we lost revenue, and then, you know, as Mets fans, because now we've got a face. This is sad, but I really can't thank you enough for having me, and Ashley, thank you for setting this up quickly. We're trying to do this before January because, as everyone knows, both New York and what you're going to have in Texas, you know, change is coming come January 1st, 2nd, whenever everyone got sworn in. And then it's going to get very busy for all of you in a very big way, and things are going to be changing for us. So I really do appreciate you taking time and doing this now, and hopefully this is not the last time you'll see me, because we really do plan on doing a lot more stuff in Texas. The reason for that is a woman who will be coming in the room soon, Betty Wu Adams, is a member of our board, the Disability Opportunity Fund, but she's an Austin resident now and has a very extensive background in the federal level, helping human services, as well as when she was in the city of New York working in different capacities as well. So she will be joining us. So the reason that we have really committed to Texas is because we have a board member who is here and wants us to be very, very committed to her home state. So, not me here, but I'm here.
Thanks.
That's great. All right, so what I'm going to do, I know everybody, and for everyone on the phone, hopefully you have the PowerPoint, so I'm going to walk through it with you. There may be a lot of questions. What I try to do is talk quickly, which is easy for me, and that gives people a lot more time to ask questions at the end. So jot down all your questions. Let me go through all of this, and then the rest of the time I'm here is to basically have the dialogue. So if we go to the second page, where it's what's an investment bank, the best way to explain to you what the Disability Opportunity Fund is the way we describe it is, first let's educate you as to what an investment bank is, and when you look at it, it basically breaks down into these categories where they would look at mergers and acquisitions, corporate finance, sales and trading, and they raise money for their clients. That's it, right. So that using that as a basis of the world that I used to live in the terms of investment banking, what we wanted to do is now combine it with what we call the state of disability. So we're on to the next slide for those on the phone, And if you look at the state of disability services, you know, there really isn't very much that's in debate, right? Under the policy side, you know, we're not going to have another American with Disabilities Act. That is the civil rights law. There obviously was, you know, the authorization of it a few years ago from the Supreme Court. Olmstead was already decided, where obviously you'll have implementation of Olmstead, and I know in the DADS office you have Mark Gold who does that here. So that's not going to be new. There really is nothing new that's going to come out of that in terms of what the decision was. And the IDEA obviously has been around since, you know, the 70s, and the reason why that I put that up there in terms of the state of disability services, because IDEA from back in the 70s is causing all of the what we call issues, right? It's not problems, but it's the fact that all of the children from back then are now educated and are trying to be in the community and employment and such. So again, policy is we're going to educate our kids. Olmstead is we're going to, you know, get them to live in the community. And the American with Disabilities Act is basically saying you're not going to discriminate. So there's not really not much new that's going to be happening in that regard. However, on the dollar side, you know, who pays for all this stuff? It's obviously the federal, state, and local programs. And unless I'm, you know, not understanding Texas, I think Texas is very much like all the other states that we work in. You know, basically those agencies are always looking at the voluntary agencies to deliver the services. But where are the problems? Obviously, this is universal. We have budget shortfalls, greater responsibility now falling on the families by what's going to happen in the future, which brings us to the next slide of what is the Disability Opportunity Fund. So now we combine those two things. We are, in essence, an investment bank, even though we are nonprofit. We are an investment bank for disabilities, for all of those issues that were just up on the screen. That little quote, middle of difficulty lies opportunity, sits in my office every day, and that is really what has driven us over the last number of years, because we know there is difficulty, but we look at it and say, all right, well, that's an opportunity to make things better, not, well, there's difficulty and that's the end of the story. So now if you combine those, you know, concepts from investment banking and you basically look at what we do, here's where the matchup comes, which is you have sales and trading. What we do is we have a loan portfolio. So we are a nonprofit community development financial institution, which is a term of art, and you have many community development financial institutions here in Texas. And we are just, you know, giving out loans, and our focus is on housing, schools, community centers, anyone who needs to borrow money to fill in niches of financing. That's the role we play on the condition that it has some nexus to disabilities. On the what we call giving advice side, that's basically what we do for something like today, where we are running around giving technical assistance. Sometimes we will actually get paid fees, so there have been groups that have come to us and said, we have a project, we have a problem, we don't know how to solve that problem, could you come in and actually help us solve that problem? There's a transaction. They need us to actually execute a transaction for them, maybe not using our balance sheet, by using either their balance sheet or somebody else's, and then we get actually revenue for those transactions. And the last thing is, which happens to us every single day, while I'm not in the office today, there will be emails, there will be phone calls, and we get this what we call pipeline of deals where people need us to help them find the capital, right? And in this environment, that's a very novel, expertise to have, which is, you know, to say, well, this is the way it's always been done, and there's no more money because there's budget shortfalls, end of story. And then we say, no, that's not the end of the story, so let's open up this can and see what we can come up with and be very creative. So that's what we do each day. I literally wake up every morning. Our focus is people with disabilities. I'll give you a little personal background as to why that is. And we opened up shop, so to speak, a few years ago with this model And now here we are a few years later, and we actually have a lending portfolio, which I'm going to show you some of the transactions we've done. And we are going all over the country to have these kind of discussions with government agencies, with parents, with nonprofit providers, and anyone else who will listen to us, to basically say, where is life today? I am not going to teach you about Texas, but you're going to teach me what you're trying to solve. And then I'm going to tell you, well, if I look at Texas, here is the way I would look at it. And, oh, do you know what's going on in New York and California and Virginia and all these other things that we've been seeing? So that's the dialogue that goes back and forth. Obviously, a day like today, there's no money being traded, and I wasn't paid to come here today. This, for us, is about what we're trying to do, which is really change the way things are going to be happening in the future and the way things are going to be thought of. That's what we do. That I've been able to explain to people. I guess we're going to restart later. We're on to the, for those on the phone, we're on to the next slide with the diagram of the circles. And I have been able to very confidently say that in 2006 we created this picture as what we wanted the DOF to become. And we've never changed this picture because we actually stuck to our guns. And all we wanted to do was sit in the middle, not because of ego, but because you as government agencies may not always be talking to banks. Government agencies may not even know what a CDFI is because housing, in the world that we were living in other states, housing didn't talk to the service providing side. So housing is here, and the medical model is over here. Never the two shall meet. So we actually have been playing this role of getting people to actually talk to each other, and then we're actually getting the money to move between the circles as well, and that's been a lot of fun. Moving on to the next slide, I'm going to introduce Community Development Financial Institutions. So that is, again, a term of art. I put this up so that you can understand that, again, on the pieces, the United States Treasury Department 15 years ago created the CDFI Fund, right, Community Development Financial Institution Fund, out of the Treasury. That was 15 years ago. That was in reaction to CDFIs creating a really a grassroots industry 30 years ago. So that would be, and you know, driving from the airport, when Betty and I were driving here, we passed by the Texas CDC. So I don't have a lot of history on them, but I just saw their sign. So a CDC, a community development corporation, you know, being a bad neighborhood, you know, economically disadvantaged, try to build it back up. Those kind of organizations have been around for many, many years. The U.S. Treasury Department really formalized it 15 years ago, and they actually go out and certify CDFIs. Now, we happen to be a certified CDFI. There are 925 in the country as of the end of October. Of those, as you can see, 77 are based in New York, and you have here, you know, 40 in the state of Texas. Just to put it in perspective, though, we are the only one in the whole country that is working nationally where our exclusion is people with disabilities. So you will have other CDFIs, and they may do a project for, you know, people with disabilities. They may have supported a school or whatever it may be, housing. But our mandate is only to focus on disabilities. And we didn't do that, again, because of ego. We actually did a market study for over a year to make sure that we weren't duplicating efforts from somebody else. So we were actually trying to do this in terms of filling a niche. And as you're about to see, we think we've been finding that niche pretty well. So for those on the phone, we're going to go to the first case study, which is called the Cottage in Darien. I have three or four. I don't know how many did I give. Three or four case studies?
Three.
Okay. Okay, so here are three case studies. We've got many more to discuss, but obviously for brevity, I wanted to explain this. So here's where novel money comes into play with the realities of a situation. Darien, Connecticut, for those who don't know, in the state of Texas, is probably the most expensive property in the state of Connecticut. So you have Greenwich and Darien. I mean, these are really, really expensive neighborhoods. You have six sets of parents who 12 years ago knew that they had young adults, or they had kids, you know, teenagers, who were going to be young adults after the age of 21, 22, aging out of the school system, and all six families whose kids all knew each other, they socialized together, three male, three female, they wanted them to live within the same area of Darien, Connecticut. But how do you do affordable housing in, you know, the most expensive real estate pretty much in the state of Connecticut and the country? And the way they did it was they were incredibly persistent, right? So they needed to figure out the land, right? They needed to figure out who's going to build the house, and then, of course, where are they going to find the money to do all of this? So how did they end up solving this problem? Very creatively, because they worked with the town of Darien over and over and over again. Guys, you got to help us. You got to find this out. These are your, you know, constituents as well. We need something. We need something. And sure enough, after years and years and years, the town of Darien was shutting down a middle school and converting it into a senior center. And they were moving the middle school. I shouldn't have said shut down. They were actually moving the middle school to a different building. So what does every middle school have? A playground. What do senior citizens not need? A playground. So they said to the parents, enough already. We got it. Here's an acre of land, but we're not giving it to you. We'll lease it to you for $1 a year for 40 years with a 40-year option. But you have to build the house. We're done. All right, we did our part. We gave you a piece of land, so that saved you X amount of dollars from having to actually acquire land. So first box is done. Now they have to actually build a house. So they go to the architect. What is a house for six adults, three male, three female, so they wanted to keep sort of two wings of the house, build an office in the middle of the house that we'd be able to have for the service provider and have all the, you know, amenities of the house. What would that cost? Architect comes back, and it's about $1 million. It's a lot of money, $1 million. And let's have a reserve fund for about $100,000, $200,000 so that, you know, a sinking fund, so if there are repairs or anything else going on. So now you have six sets of parents, and no one is sitting there saying, oh, I got $1 million here, let's go build the house. So they got creative, and what they did was they set up a nonprofit called The Cottage in Darien, a 501c3. Why did they do that? Because with that, now all of a sudden, the parents didn't want to own the house in their own name. The kids could not own the house in their own name because then that would have, you know, violated all of the requirements on any of the state funding that they were going to get. So what the parents did is they created The Cottage in Darien, and they started the proverbial car washes, brownie sales, whatever it would take, nickels and dimes, and everyone started to fundraise to put this house together. And it took them about 5 years, and they got halfway there, about $600,000. Well, they could have taken another 5 years to finish it up, but now what ended up happening in box number three is they got introduced to community development financial institutions. And in this case, which was very, very interesting, and why dialogue is really important, really, really important. There was a community development financial institution called the Leviticus Fund, and the man who runs that is a man by the name of Dave Rayner. So now let's go backwards to go forwards. Back in 2008, June of 2008, I did this kind of a session for 250 people in New York, and he was one of them. I didn't know him personally, but we sent an invitation out to local CDFIs, and he showed up. And somebody spoke at our function, and at the end of the function, he ran into them and said, oh, I have this transaction that's going on, and I wasn't going to do it, but now that I've heard you talk about the need of what is going to be required for, you know, people with disabilities, and they would have no else to go, and they would end up in state institutions and such, I want to go do that deal. That, then he ended up not only doing the deal, joining our board, and then asked us to participate. So what happens? In that case, the Leviticus Fund and the Disability Opportunity Fund jointly came in to lend The Cottage in Darien $685,000, the remaining money that was going to be needed. How did we do this? Okay? And what were the terms and everything else? Well, what we wanted to do was make it as feasible and economically feasible as possible to do this loan. So you could go in and get a traditional 30-year mortgage, just like everybody else could get, except they couldn't. Why? There's no collateral. No bank is going to collateralize the land because the town owns the land, and they're not going to collateralize the house because it's bricks and, you know, what are you going to do, take back the siding of the house? This was a great way to bridge that. And we provided, in this case, 5-year paper. Rather than 30-year paper, we did 5-year paper on interest only on a 20 and 25-year amortization. So therefore, we took the payments out all the way, but the corpus was going, and the principal was only going to be on a 5-year basis, with this hope that within the 5 years, that either they would continue to go fundraise to pay off the principal, or we just roll over in 5 years, roll over the loan again, or we then convince a conventional banker to come in and say, look, here's 5 years, they have never missed a payment, this is a perfect loan, you guys should be taking over this loan because it's just as solid as anything else. So that's how they got the construction done, and all of the folks moved in March of 2009. So we're just about 2 years into this. I was up there a month ago. House is gorgeous. It's perfect. And everyone's very, very happy. All 6 are working in the community. They're all doing their activities, doing their typical dayhab and such, and it's magnificent. Now, how are they paying the loan back? Where's the debt service on that? Well, now that's where the monthly payments to each of the 6 come in from the state of Connecticut. One side is paying for the Department of Services is paying for the service side, and there was a rental subsidy that they were getting from the housing side. So two different payment streams, and they go into the cottage in Darien. And that way, the cottage in Darien pays back whatever they need to for our loan, takes the overage, puts it into another account so they have money that's going to help them going forward. So very creative. Very different. That's why we called this, you know, sort of investment banking thinking. You know, you have to think a little out of the box, and now we've taken this model and we've been sort of selling it, so to speak, showing it to others down the road. Yes.
Can we go back to the,
please,
just to make sure I heard it twice and it still hasn't registered, the part where we go back to the conventional lender. So they had the loan, they had the money, they had the loan. There was a, just I'm saying this out loud, they would go through a period of time of making payments on time and everything was going well. And that's the point at which you would go to a conventional lender?
Well, we're right now, so we lent them the money as of March of 2009 so they could move into their, you know, to finish the construction, move into the house.
Right.
So there was that period of time from, you know, the end of 2008 until 2009.
They were making payments.
And then the second we closed on that loan, every month there's a check that shows up that goes first to Leviticus Fund, and because we're participating with Leviticus, then they cut us our check. So the two banks, in this case, the two CDFIs, get our interest payments. And in this case, the parents who are managing this for the young adults, they actually, even though we didn't require it, they're starting to pay a little principal because things are going so well. So, yeah, the payments just keep coming in and coming in. And this is a very nice loan for us because it's at 6%. On interest only for the 5 years, that's a very nice, you know, you can't get five-year paper.
The loan was structured for the first 5 years with interest only.
Interest only.
And then that's where they established the track record.
Correct.
And then that's the point at which you would go to a conventional lender.
As one option, absolutely.
To see him. Now, if that lender said, yeah, this looks good, we take it, then you would do...
Well, then the lender would come in and replace the $685. Now we get our money back, and then we'll go and see what's in our pipeline and go apply. So this week, just to sort of digress for a moment, this week, last week, last Friday, we got a phone call out of the blue from someone we lent money to 6 months ago, and we gave them a 5-year piece of paper, and they emailed us on last Friday, we're done, we're good, we're construction starting, because it was meant for pre-development. And they said, oh, we're way ahead of schedule. We're paying the money back.
I'm like, great. So all of a sudden, where I didn't think I had $125,000 to start 2011, we now called my lending folks and said, go get us another loan. That, you know, so now all of a sudden somebody else who I said, oh, we'll see you in 6 months, now we said, oh, guess what? You know, get the paperwork ready. We're going to be able to lend to you. So this is a revolving loan fund. We're just trying to keep the money moving.
The strategy by having that conventional lender, that money for you to do more of it. And that's
absolutely. Now, one last policy thing before we go to the next case study. Policy-wise, and this is critical, 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 especially for you guys in Texas. The key here is that the service provider does not own the house. Okay? This is what we are calling decoupling or unbundling. A house is now in, yes, the name of the Cottage and Darien, but what we like to call the three C's, choice, control, and community, all six, no one's kicking them out of this house. If the service provider does not provide services that is not to the level of the liking of the parents, guardians, or whomever, guess what? A service provider gets fired, the kids, I shouldn't say that anymore, the young adults do not get kicked out of the house. Big, big difference. And this is a big, real policy shift. I'm going to show you on some other things that we're working on why this is going to be necessary. You guys know it. I mean, you're dealing with the budget issues, and we're going to show how with this new financial model, we're going to start dividing up how do you handle the financing on house, how do you handle finance and services, and you make those two work, it's a whole new world, whole new world. Yes?
I have a question on the housing component.
Please.
I mean, is there some type of lure on the land, the type of, let's say one of the young adults wants to move out, I'm assuming that you still need an individual with some type of disability to take over and live in that unit, and so the rental subsidy is tied to that room or unit, or how does that work?
Excellent question. Excellent, excellent question. Yes, no. Meaning, yes, someone can move out. And no, it's not tied to the unit. It's still tied to the person. So here's where it's different. In this case, and again, a lot of different models, but here's this case. This is a nonprofit. They have a 501c3, and they have bylaws, and they have a board and everything else. So they will choose who will be able to come in versus saying, oops, it's off of a waiting list, and you're just going to put someone's not compatible for either the new person or the existing five. Unbelievable story in this one. Unbelievable story. Over the 12 years it took to get these young adults there, one of the set of parents passed away, both mom and dad. And that young man ended up in foster care while the house was being constructed. And the other five made it their commitment to the parents who passed away because they already had bylaws, because they already set up the five. You know, everyone was sort of, there were no siblings, there was nobody else. The day that house was done, they plucked him out of foster care, and as I said, I just saw him a couple of weeks ago. So that's, again, is this an anecdote, great Charlie, nice story? No, this is something that can be replicated and is being replicated over and over and over. This is a very, you know, not to use my kids' language, this is a very cool story. I mean, this is a very, you know, hot way to do something different. By necessity. I mean, they weren't trying. Trust me, these parents are not trying to be trailblazers. They were just trying to exist. And the other cool part of that story was the day that those kids moved in, there was one other set of parents who went on their first vacation in 26 years. Mm-hmm. Their 26-year-old daughter moved in, and it was the first time they were actually able to go have some time. Yes, you have a question.
And I wasn't sure I heard you right. Did you say the rental subsidy stayed with the property or
the person.
So the next person coming in had to have a voucher or whatever.
Or they could pay rent.
Or they had to have the income to pay
the
rent.
Yeah. So that way it was really, or what they're shooting for ultimately, right, is that, you know, they'll pay off this loan so they could live rent-free, so to speak. It's their house. They don't.
Where I was headed is I was wondering whether or not the housing authority issued a voucher to group living arrangements.
Right. So in this case,
under the Housing Act.
Exactly. And in this case, it's to the person because it would just like be buying an apartment, you know, renting an apartment. There, it's the person. It's not a group home. So it looks like a group home, talks like a group home, but it's not because the state doesn't own it. State's not running it. It's non-certified. and it's the parents who, or the guardians
the
who...
The nonprofit owns it.
And the nonprofit mm-hmm. is okay. owns the thing. And again, anybody on the phone who has questions, and I'm trying to go as fast as I can, jump in whenever you want. Okay, the next one I think I put up, yes. Okay, now this is good, and I'll tell you why this is a good one for you to understand, because we have, in our organization, and I explained this to Betty, we had our board meeting yesterday, and Betty was on the phone, and then we told her again today, our next house that we're probably going to lend to is going to be in the state of Texas. We've made a commitment on that, as I explained to you, because Betty is here, and we want to get our footprint in Texas. How are we going to do that? In this case, there's two organizations. One's called Scioto Properties, for-profit, okay, totally different model now, for-profit, and there's another one called CapGrow, and they're also for-profit. So Scioto is based in Dublin, Ohio, and CapGrow is in Chicago. Their model has been to do what the fast food chains do. They own the box, okay? Somebody owns the franchise and actually flips the burgers. Somebody else owns the real estate. Well, that's what these guys do. They own the box. They own single-family homes all across the country, and then they rent them out to service provider or to the person with disability, whoever is doing it. Even though they're a for-profit company, these are nonprofit service provider guys who started the company, so they know they're working off of very thin margins. This is not market rate housing. This is for very low income folks who have disabilities. Right? Very unique. Didn't even know, you know, and it was so fascinating. We put our website up in 2008. Let's say it was sort of May of 2008. In August of 2008, we get a phone call from these guys saying, who are you and why don't we know who you are? Okay? And we hadn't even started our lending at that point. And they flew out from Dublin and we started a relationship back then, and we actually lent them money to do two homes, okay, in the state of Tennessee. Now, how did those homes go? In that case, you had two homes, small homes, one was for three women and one was for two men. And the state of Tennessee, in these very poor neighborhoods, came in and said, look, we'll put up $40,000 as down payment assistance on each of the homes to use Scioto Properties. Now it's with the property, on condition that somebody who is low income with disabilities lives here forever. Okay? So you get this, otherwise we find out, then you owe us the money back. So that was there. For the whopping sum of $115,000, $55,000 on one house and $60,000 on the other house, we lent Scioto Properties those two amounts of money on top of the $40,000, you know, subsidy that the government was giving. And now five people with disabilities are living in the community. All five have jobs. All are taxpayers. And it's just a simple, great story. Roof caves in. Lawn needs to be cut. And that's their problem. That's Scioto's, their landlord. That's all they're doing. So again, another totally different model. I didn't hear parents here. I didn't hear government. It's a totally different model. It was so fascinating to be with these guys for the last couple of years. What I put up on the board here is the fact that they need two things. They have a current line of credit that's basically running at about 7%. So they need to refinance as cheap as possible, and obviously with the way rates are right now, you know, they want to continue to refinance. Their challenge are the banks don't understand the, where are you getting the rent from, and, you know, what is this housing authority, and what's, and, you know, it's very, and they're in so many different states. So they're having trouble sort of articulating this, and they're trying to do it piecemeal, and we're trying to help them do this on a more, you know, global scale of saying, okay, you know, how do we help you refinance, because they're going to turn that money, not buy Maseratis for themselves, but they're going to turn and do more homes, and that's the key. They also need new capital, and that's where we come into play as well. So as I said, we just got this $125,000 back. They're going to do new housing, so they need new capital to do new housing. In terms of what size of loans they want, I'm not kidding about that. They literally can handle as small as $50,000 doing one house right now, and they could have the capacity to do over $50 million worth of new business over the next couple of years. That's how much demand that they've had because of the issues that all of you are dealing with in the other states, which is moving people out of state institutions into the community. Someone has to fill that void. So this is another sort of case study.
Are the folks that come to these very often, like the waiver providers in states that are looking for the homes, you know, the ones that are deinstitutionalizing?
I think yes.
And
so they have their voucher.
They've already got the funding set. They just need a place. It's much more convenient than trying to get one from general community stock.
And who's going to run?
Right.
So there is no stock.
Right.
And who's going to run the house? And who's going to fix the house? And who's going to? So this is a nice solution, right? Not for everybody, but it is a nice solution for some to say, oh, great, you're going to handle all that, that's great. And again, from a housing authority standpoint, it's all contractually done that you have to live within what we need and you can't go outside the box. So if you stop serving people with disabilities, well, you lose all the benefits and now we go back.
Do they build, buy, or both?
Both. Okay. Both. So they'll buy, especially, and that's why they need our capital as much as possible right now, because given the current economic and real estate market, they've got properties all over that they want to snatch up, okay, and even if they have to put some money into retrofit, that's fine, and then they're building from scratch also. They have a piece of land, and they can throw up a house, you know, relatively quickly.
And they're only working with service providers. They're not working with the individuals.
They can work. They will work with individuals as well. So there are some high functioning folks who, you know, oh, I have my voucher. Great. So it's both. They, as long as there's the rental income.
And when you say service providers, how do you define that?
Well, I guess I'm using it as a catch-all. I mean, a service provider can either be, you know, well, it depends who's providing services. So it could be a state agency, or it could ultimately be, you know, a nonprofit service provider.
Okay.
So I use that sort of as a catch-all, not to really define it.
Well, I only asked because you were talking about how the medical side, the health side, and the housing side don't speak. So I'm on that housing side that hasn't spoken with the
right.
health side, and so I'm just trying to figure out how that's, you know,
defined. My guess is it's a 1915C waiver provider that's providing the services.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Correct. That's exactly right. And that's why, again, this is not the despondent story of, oh, there's so many bad things. It's the sense that there are a lot of good things going on. Now, can we piece it together in a way that no one's ever thought of before to make that work?
Absolutely.
So, all right, last case study. This one will be a little quicker because it's about a school, just to show you the breadth of the kinds of things we work on. This is a simple one. No magic here. It was a school started by a small group of folks for their children with autism. Autism, 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 right? We're going to talk a lot about that. It's just exploding. I mean, absolutely exploding. Now, again, I didn't give you my whole personal background. I have a 21-year-old daughter with cerebral palsy. She's a junior in college. She's incredibly independent. We were hoping she was going to be independent when she was a kid, and we pushed and pushed and pushed. Thankfully, really, the brain works, it's the legs that don't work, and she's not only so independent, she's on an airplane right now coming from Florida back to New York, you know, for winter break. Autism, though, is a whole new world, and I don't even want to sit in the shoes of the parents who we meet all the time who are trying to deal with those issues. This is an example of a very creative group of parents, had 13 kids, they wanted to set up a life skills school for their children with autism in Brooklyn, New York, and they did it by literally having some little house in the community, and they started the school, and the state sort of gave them their charter to be able to do it, and, you know, it's been working. Well, it's been working so well that two things happen. One, they've been attracting more and more students to the point where they've outgrown this little house, and they went ahead and found something in the community where there was a piece of property available. And the key for that piece of property was the fact that there was enough property to build a new school, but there was also some property next to that where they were ultimately going to think about, as their kids got older, having some residential. So that's in the future. But going back to the school, they went to the state. This was back in 08. and they were able to get an appropriation to construct. So they, as the parents, went to the bank to get the couple million dollars they needed to acquire the land. This is New York, and it was, you know, a very valuable piece of property in Brooklyn. The parents, in this case, some of the parents, not all of them, because they're not all of means, some of the parents who did have means signed personal guarantees, as well as, of course, as collateral on the land. So that's how the bank said, okay, we'll do that loan. The state of New York came in with $1 million to start the construction of the school, but it was going to be about $1.25 million. So there was that gap. They approached us to do the $250,000 construction loan to help finish that up, which we did. And that construction was finished about a month ago, and they're going to officially move in January. Again, what we did was to give them some flexibility and not say, unlike a bank that would say, you have 12 months and on day, you know, 12 months plus one, we better have our money or we're foreclosing. We said, keep the money for 5 years, even though we know you're not going to use it for 5 years. So it gave them a chance to breathe. We stretched out the interest payments again to make it cheaper for them. And, of course, what they're about to do is wrap in to one loan, the acquisition loan that they had, the construction loan they have with us, into a new financing arm. Why? Because now they're doubling the capacity of the students, which means that double the amount of tuition, and all the pro formas basically say they're going to be able to do the debt service blindfolded. I mean, it's going to be very, very easy for them to handle. Now, our balance sheet will not handle the permanent financing because that's going to be a couple million dollars. We're still small. We're growing. But that was a very nice piece of business to hand off to a traditional bank who is in that business,
right,
and say, great, now everyone's happy and we all sort of get to go home. Again, very creative in terms of parent-driven for a market that is just exploding at this point. We got to sort of fill our niche. We'll get out of it. We get to feel like we built a school, and now we sort of move on. All right? So those are our case studies, and we've got plenty more stories, but I know I'm taking up a lot of the time. These next couple of slides is really me trying to be cute. I actually do this in New York with the New York office of people with the developmental disabilities. What I'm trying to show here is obviously the trend. What are the trends that we're seeing, which is obviously the state agencies are going to have to continue to play a lesser and lesser role. They don't have a choice. You just can't handle all of this demand. So there are going to be those pressures. We are also seeing, and I don't know if you're seeing this in Texas, we are seeing this around the country. We're seeing mergers and acquisitions of agencies. The agencies, the nonprofit voluntary agencies, are having trouble with all of these cuts. And what they're getting, the boards of directors are getting pretty smart about is, all right, well, let's not do another black tie dinner and golf outing. Let's actually find somebody who we can merge with and make, you know, some synergies there. We are seeing a lot of this. And the last thing, I don't know if this really tells the story, but it's basically the increased, you know, sort of reliance on the families going where it used to be, the families telling the state, here's my kid, take care of my kid, and now the state turning around and saying, well, you got to be a partner in this thing because we can't do it all. So I don't know how cute all those three slides were, but that tells that story. This is one piece I want to leave you with because I think I only have a couple more slides. This is very critical, and this is me being on the bully pulpit a little bit. ABLE Act is, anyone in the room here know at what ABLE Act is? Okay, so I'm doing good work. That's good. ABLE Act, this is a piece of federal legislation, okay, and I looked at this as of 2 days ago, so this should be the most current, and those names on the left-hand side should be familiar to all of you. This, in essence, would be the 529 college account that's now for kids. For family members who have disabilities, for everything that they would need under the sun. In essence, ABLE is Achieving a Better Life Expectancy Act, Experience Act, went into the Senate and the House on the same exact day. So those two pieces of the legislation have the exact same language. There are 20-some-odd co-sponsors on the Senate side. Neither one of your senators, unless I missed it, are a co-sponsor of it. And on the House side, there are 203 co-sponsors, and there's your list of your representatives who are co-sponsors. Here's the basis of it. You're going to be able, unlike a 529, which is tax-deferred, this would be up to $500,000 that you could put away tax-free. And then you can use it, and it's tax-free on disbursements on condition you use it for something that falls under the world of disability services. And because we, myself, and a couple other people were behind this, you know, drafting this legislation, disability services includes pretty much everything under the sun. Education, school, housing, transportation, scooters, taking a vacation, whatever, buying a toothbrush. It's basically anything that's going to make your life better can fall under this. This will be very, very powerful. And I have been able to talk to some of the folks in Washington to explain that while the ADA was a pretty good civil rights piece of legislation, this is even going to be better because it's talking about economic freedom. We've carved out all of the, you lose none of your exemptions under Medicaid, you lose none of your exemptions under state because this is not going to be, the money is not going to be in the name of the person. It will basically act sort of in a trust capacity. But it's going to be as easy to open up as going to the local savings bank and opening up a savings account. So this is going to be the new IRA, new 401k, the new 529. If this thing gets passed, every financial institution you guys know about walking down the street, you're going to see big signs for, you know, open up your ABLE account. Very hot. We were actually hoping that with all the turmoil in Washington right now that we were going to be able to slip this one in because it has so much support. And, you know, the top clock is ticking. I don't know whether we're really going to be able to get it done, but we're hoping you'll see this in 2011 because as you're going to see, if you go on, just Google either one of those and you'll see, you can click on to see who all the other co-sponsors are. You've got those very, very far on the right and those very, very far on the left co-sponsoring the same bill. I don't know how many other bills you got.
I imagine it has broad appeal to either party.
I mean, this is so not, you know, and they did a CBO score on this for $1.5 billion over 10 years, which I know is a lot of money for all of us in this room, but in the world of legislation, it's like pennies. So it really got a very good CBO score. Now, what I was trying to do, and obviously I changed Texas to New York and Virginia and all the other places that I give talks on, that you don't have to wait for that. I mean, you can start thinking about this in terms of the new legislature that's going to come into play. You can create a state, you know, equivalent of that, and if there's some, you know, drive to do that, we can come back and teach anyone who's willing to listen what's been going on in other states. Washington has done it. They've done the match savings, so if a family member puts in, you know, a dollar, the state puts in $4, and, you know, there've been a lot of these up to a certain amount of money and things, so you don't have to wait for the federal government to do this, even though it would be nice if they were to do it quickly, but Texas can actually do something, and again, the way we look at it is simple. You have a small budget, you know, so you're basically saying, look, parents, if you're going to go, or family members, you come to the table, meet us halfway, you put some money, we'll put some money, not all the money, then maybe that will help all of us be able to deliver services. Did I do it? That's it. So for everybody on the phone who has the PowerPoint, the last slide I want everyone to always have. So if you have projects, after everything that we've discussed, now, you should have my contact information. Actually, you have it for everybody. So, again, it's Charlie Hammerman. So I am chammerman@doof.org. But if you go to info@doof.org, it always gets to us eventually. N. Fryman, Nancy happens to be my wife and co-founder of this organization. She's been a voc rehab counselor for 25 years. So anything on the technical assistance side. And please do not hesitate. Even as Betty will tell you, we meet with parents. I mean, we go, you know, up to groups, up to obviously, you know, big organizations. Anything you need from us, we're committed to you guys here. just let us know, and we will make time. And obviously, as you could see, we have, we will make the effort to come and talk to people. And if we can do it long distance, we will. And if it needs, from a group standpoint, you need us to come down here, we will make the time to do that. And then that's our phone number that you can always reach us at. How did I do?
Great.
Good. All right. So that's the end of the formal presentation, and please, now some questions and thoughts, and anyone on the phone. All right, but not, yes?
I'm interested in how often do you work with state agencies versus nonprofits versus CDFIs? I mean, or is it just run the gamut?
It does, but the state agency side is a very important piece for us. So excellent question. Let me explain how we've been successful in doing that. First and foremost, the perfect laboratory we have is the state of New York. Okay, while everything is bigger and better in Texas, New York, believe it or not, their budget for developmental disabilities is $9 billion, and it's 5% of the whole country. So, I mean, that's a pretty good living laboratory to have to work with. We have a very, very close relationship with that agency for the last 3 years. And we have specifically said we do not want money from them, meaning even if it was a $10,000 grant, we don't want it, because we want to have a relationship where we can critique them and be critical of them and teach them how to do things better. We've done wonderful stuff with them, even though we haven't done the first house, because things in New York are bad. I mean, really, really bad. And we're going to have a new governor come January 1, and we'll see if that logjam gets broken. I will tell you what we're doing on Monday is very groundbreaking, which is three families have gotten together. In the state, remember, the one I did in Connecticut was Connecticut. We have not done this in New York yet. We just can't get the state to move. Three families have come together, same model as Connecticut, said, all right, we'll deal with the house. You, state, tell us what services you're going to pay for. On Monday, we are going to the district office that covers them from the state, and they invited us in for the first time to say, okay, we're ready to talk. We're ready to literally sit down with a piece of paper, outline exactly what we're willing to pay for. So we do work with the government agencies very, very close. I mean, really closely down to, we try to get one thing done to show that it can actually get done. The other way we handle the government agencies on a national basis is we've been incredible. If you go to our website, which I really encourage everyone to do, you're going to see currently there's one story up there about a roundtable discussion. That's what we call our signature event, a roundtable discussion with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. And then if you go into the news and archives, you'll see the others that we've done. So 3 years ago, we were incredibly fortunate to get introduced to the Federal Reserve Banking System. Why? Because the Federal Reserve Banking System really lives in your world, right, which is housing, affordable housing, asset development, all the Section 8 programs. And they've been doing these conferences for years on these issues. And we were introduced to them to say, great, love it, don't change a thing. Now, disabilities, they're seated at the table for that. And they're like, what do you mean? And we said, well, you're doing low-income housing, so how about, let's talk about, and you're trying to do things for, you know, poor people in those communities. And we were like, how about the poorest of the poor? Okay? And they didn't even know. They had no idea what the statistics were. They had no idea what the population was in terms of size. They had no idea how many people with disabilities were in SSI. I mean, they just didn't know. It wasn't about being arrogant about it. They literally were ignorant about it. So we started a dialogue with them where we have roundtable discussions. So if you know anything about the Fed system, there are 12 banks, and then the 12 banks cover the regions. So we did the first one in San Francisco, which covered a big West region. We did the next one in Chicago, which covered a lot of the Midwest. And the third one we did was in New York, and we actually held it at the New York Stock Exchange. Why did we do all of that? We'll go back to my first slide. We were trying not to be the disability advocates, and then the disability advocates talk to disability advocates, and everyone says, woe is me, and then we were trying to bring mainstream finance. We were trying to bring mainstream thinking to the table who may not have known the first thing about disabilities and say, here's this market. Why are you not, you know, presenting yourself to this market? So the one in New York, we had almost, I'd say, a third of the room were real estate developers. These are for-profit guys. They want to see where the margins are. And so it was a very unique way to sort of have this conversation. Then this year we did the Federal Reserve Board of Governors down in Washington, D.C., and that was a day-and-a-half event, which was a blowout. I mean, we had 150 people, very high levels from the federal government, HHS, HUD, Department of Labor, and talking with bankers and CDFIs, and it was a very, you know, very, very unique situation. We just did one in Richmond, Virginia, and we just did the one last week in Boston. Now, I'm really glad you asked that question, because as the audience around that table that we always get, and I say the proverbial table, I mean, these are like 50, 80, 100 people, you know, gatherings, are government agencies, the banks, the CDFIs, and as we say, we have the Fed there. So the Fed is bringing the finance arm. We know who's in the disability world, and we sort of bring them all together. In 2011, what we are hoping to do, which really is, as Ashley and I have sort of discussed, was really why we're hoping to get this started, dialogue started now, is we are talking with the Fed Bank in Dallas. And we want to run one of these in 2011, but not do it in Dallas. We actually want to do it here in Austin because of what you had just mentioned. We could do it in Dallas, and then the banks would come to Dallas. But if you don't have the government agencies, if you don't make this easy for the government to be part of the dialogue, it's going to be a waste of time. We know that. So we are actually going to try to convince the Fed Bank in Dallas to host something here, so that everyone around this table, plus you'll explain to me who else we should be including in this discussion, actually gets around the table. And it's a very interactive discussion. This is not, let's listen to a panel and a PowerPoint, and everyone starts looking at their BlackBerry and saying, when do I get back to you? This becomes very interactive. We actually, in the one in Boston, we brought three folks who were looking for financing. And how do I know? Because they came to us looking for the financing. One in Vermont, one in Rhode Island, and one in Massachusetts, so something that covered the region. And we brought them there, and I played MC and actually got them to talk about the deals that they were trying to finance. But then I had the banker. I knew the Citibank person that was there. I knew the Bank of Boston. And said, okay, what do you need to be able to do this? And if it was, well, I need to have a guarantee from the government, I had the government person sitting right there saying, okay, now you guys are going to have to talk to each other. When we were in Richmond, Virginia, and we discussed the Darien example, okay, we had a panel of folks one was the government person, so the DADS equivalent in Richmond. Richmond obviously is their capital, so that person was there. We had a CDFI, and then we had a service provider. So those were the three folks, and I did that intentionally. And the reason was is because the DADS person was only thinking about how do we spend state money. And I said, what if parents came to meet you halfway and they were willing to spend some of their money with your money? Would you be willing to do that? And she says, yeah, that'd be great. She says, people are doing that? I said, yes, they're doing that. And then I said, okay. Now, you from the CDFI, if you just heard that the state is willing to do that, does this become a more desirable deal for you to look at as something to finance? It's like, yeah, that would be great. And the service provider, I said, are you okay not owning the real estate? You're just going to provide, yeah, I would love, but I don't want more real estate. And that we literally interactively discussed it there, and we said, great, now go off and talk. The other thing that happened was the housing folks showed up in Richmond. The day after the session, I get a phone call from the City of Richmond, you know, Housing Development Office, and they said, we were there in that room. I said, great. And they said, guess what? We have a nursing home that we shut down 2 years ago. So it's this building, this empty building that had 52 beds. It's sitting on 10 acres of property. We don't know what to do with it. And after we heard what we heard yesterday, we now want to convert it into affordable apartments. Can you come down and help us figure out how to do that? So again, a little dialogue, you know, goes a long way, and that's what we're going to hope to do down here. So next year we're hoping to do Philly. As I said, there are 12 banks. We're hoping to sort of make our way around the whole country and then, you know, continue to go over again. But we're hoping to do Philly, Atlanta, and Dallas. That's our goal. So we're obviously looking for your support in the sense of saying, yeah, it's worth that dialogue, because once we pull the Fed in, you guys are the more important audience. So we want to make sure this is something you actually want to engage in. Very long answer to a short question. But
great answer.
Other thoughts, questions?
Well, one question I had was, how do you guys evaluate integration issues for residential developments that you're working on, as far as not only integrating them within a community, but then allowing for integrated settings for people with disabilities?
Okay, again, excellent question. Okay, and again, this is, you know, I could have showed you 20 case studies, and it's just trying to pick a few. Point program. Point program, a lot of different models. Point programs in Westchester County, New York. Service provider says we want an integrated setting. So how are they going to do this? Well, in White Plains, New York, they found an apartment building with, let's say, 150 units. They then go, and it's all rentals. So they go ahead and talk to the owner of the building, and they end up taking 10 of those units as rentals. As a cluster, not a cluster meaning in one hallway, but, you know, spattered throughout the building. So now, out of the 8 units, 10 they took, 8 of them, 2 bedrooms each. So no, it's no SROs or anything else, you know, real apartments. So you have now 16 young adults who are going to live in an integrated setting. These are higher functioning Asperger's, you know, kids. But they still need supports. They need to push in. They don't need the 24/7. So the other 2 units that they rented, one was sort of home base for the service provider. That was their office, so that the kids all knew that in the building they had a place to go to if they needed help. And the last one was like a assisted living, not assisted living, it was like a model for daily living.
ADL.
Thank you. It was like to go so you could bring the new ones in, you know, who are going to get ready a year from now and show them what a stove was and what it's like to be in a house, you know, so they weren't, you know, stay for a night, stay for a weekend to learn how to live. So the transition into that. So that's one example of how they took the same model, right? So now you don't have to worry about how are you going to build something? It was already there. You just took the rental subsidies. And in that case, what they started to do to try to, this was, I think, back in 05, 06, what they started to do was they did it with the parents, because the parents were nervous as heck about this. You know, my kid, he's autistic, and he's never lived on his own. How's this going to work? So they did a one-year lease to see if it was going to sort of work. At the same time, in that one-year trial, you know, the parents were figuring out sort of, all right, we'll cover the rent for the first year. But at the same time, the service provider was working with the state government to basically say, look, if this is successful, then you're going to provide this subsidy, not the whole rent, but a part of the rent, so to to cover it, so that it avoids 16 young adults, you know, going to live in some institution or some other setting. So that was one example of an integrated setting. Other integrated settings is where these homes are. So the one in Darien, Connecticut, I mean, it's right there. I mean, you can't tell. It's one house just on a whole block of other homes. As I said, the ones that Scioto does and such, they're just single family. They're not, you know, they're not all clustered up and such. Now, here's what's interesting and here's what's going to happen. And you're going to see this as a trend, especially with the autism. You have Olmsted, right? So Olmsted saying least restrictive environment in the community. Well, what they're really thinking about is my daughter Stephanie. You know, my daughter Stephanie is a disability snob. You know, she doesn't want to be with other people with disabilities. You know, she wants to be independent and stuff. So she's basically going to be an Olmsted person that someone would say, well, she should live, you know, in the community with everybody else. Autism is going to be a totally different world. What is happening with the parents there and the service providers is they are coming to us in droves. Now, we have a formal memorandum of understanding with Autism Speaks, right? Why? Because Autism Speaks, if you go to their website now, they don't do housing. But what is happening? All of their constituents who are giving them lots of money to do research have kids now that are 22, 23, and they say, my kid's never getting cured, but he needs a place to live. And Autism Speaks does this. What do you want me to do? We don't do housing. So we stepped into the fold. We met them 2 years ago, and we predicted this. And we said, why don't you tell everyone you're doing housing by then referring them to us, and we'll start building this up. And it's been very successful. Why? Because they have been getting that first phone call, and that's great. We want them to because they're the brand, right? We're not going to start a whole new brand of autism in Texas. So let them call the Texas Office of Autism Speaks. But then let that phone call come into us, and we've got the factory going, you know. Parents are coming to us with crazy ideas. When I say crazy, it's because they've never been tried before, but I think they're brilliant. They're clustering within a community, okay? So they're basically saying, of course we want our kids to be in the community, but you know what? My kid's a headbanger, and you can't just throw him into an apartment and then say, okay, go. No, he's going to need 24/7, and he wants to be with Johnny or Sally because they know each other from respite. So they're creating these clusters. And then they're basically saying, yeah, but we want them in the community. So you're going to see this push and pull because the disability advocacy world is going to actually, you know, reject some of this. And so you can't do that. I will tell you one, which is at the total other end of the spectrum. And I know as state folks, you don't want to hear about only private pay situations, but they are happening also. And the only way to really think about these is, those are going to be less people on your rolls. So, you know, these models are going to be out there. There is one situation going on right now in Alpharetta, Georgia, where it is, if you, I'm assuming you guys have the over 55 communities here. They are creating a 40 to 45 person community. Gorgeous, absolutely beautiful with all the amenities and everything else. Pure private pay, 100% private pay. And what they're going to put, they're going to have the cluster of the living arrangements, and then what they're going to put in the back of the building is a huge voc training facility, not just for the 40, but for the whole community of those with autism. And then they're obviously going to get them to have meaningful work, volunteer efforts, whatever is going to keep them busy during the day. Well, you start talking about that with some of the disability advocates, they're going to go nuts on that. They're like, that's an institution, and we don't care how many flowers there are. That's no. Go back to my three C's, choice, control, and the community. So the fact is that this is the trend that we're going to have to start bridging, which is the fact is that for this population, it works. Not when I say population, I'm not talking about the whole autism spectrum, but for this group, these parents are finding a solution that works for their child. We all have to breathe a, you know, sigh of relief saying, great, if that works, and that's terrific. And if the state's not getting involved with it and it's not costing more money or doing, then we have to be even triply happy about it, because otherwise you're going to end up with 40 new entrants onto the doles and the rolls and the sense of saying, you know, now what are we going to do? Because there's no way, as state agencies, you're going to be able to do what these guys do. So I think what we're seeing is an incredible spectrum, to use the autism spectrum, you know, terminology, of solutions that are going to answer the question that you asked, which is, what about this community integration? Community integration is just going to take on a whole new meaning. After I was in the Boston Fed, I went, drove up 2 hours to Brattleboro, Vermont. Schools for kids with autism started by three parent groups for three kids 2 years ago. They're up to 13 kids. Brattleboro sits on the border of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont, right there. Like literally 2 minutes you're in New Hampshire and 10 minutes you're in Massachusetts. Well, they've got school districts now willing, from even though they're in Vermont, from Massachusetts to New Hampshire, take our kids because we can't handle them. Take our kids. So this tiny little school is now already only 2 years old, looking to expand to a new school, but they're not just saying, okay, let's go build a new school and then we have a school. And no, they're already thinking 10 years out. What did they come to me with? Okay, so we got all this property. Now, Vermont property, we're already starting to think, well, this looks like a farm. No. What this is, it's a fascinating corporate campus. That's what this is. Now, when we look at a corporate campus and we look at buildings with glass and you know, sort of the structures we're sitting in now, it's the coolest thing up there because their corporate campus all looks like barns. Inside the barns, though, there's high-tech companies going on in these things. So from the outside, it's like we did hit a farm, and then when you dig deeper, like, wow, this is incredible. So there's this very ingenious guy who owns this 160 acres. And you talk about community. Brattleboro, Vermont, is a literally small community. Everyone knows everybody else's business up there. So this gentleman, who's pretty much the town, says to that school 3 years ago, hey, I got this on this 160 acres. I got this dilapidated house. It's all yours. You can have that. Bring it up the side of the mountain there, but now you're going to pay me rent, you know, and start your school, which they did. They added some, you know, siding to the house, and so they're running this little school, and now the school's starting to outgrow. At the same time, they've now discussed with him, wait, we want that property over there because we're going to build some housing. He said, oh, glad you're going to build housing because I was just about to start building market rate housing because his corporate campus is growing and growing and growing, and now he needs a place for these folks to live. So he just got, I'm not a fan of 3D, but Universal Studios gave him the contract to build their new 3D glasses because his, you know, technology is the best they got. So he's now going to be putting up this new building. There are going to be employees. So you talk, again, we're talking community. So while this autism little group is saying, hey, we want to create something for ourselves, they're not going to be off on their own. It's going to be integrated now with other housing. Wait, we didn't finish yet. The school they're going to vacate, because we're going to help them build the new school, like, you know, go from about 2,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet, another piece of property. The 2,000 square foot building, they've already worked with somebody who's on their board who owns the pizza place in town. And we think about a little pizza place. No, this guy, like, it's a franchise. So he has agreed to donate a franchise to this school so that these young, you know, teenagers now who are getting their training at his pizza place, they're going to run their own restaurant as young adults, right? So now they're living in this apartment. Their work is right there. They're running a restaurant slash pizza place. And in the bottom of the school, they're actually going to, the school is going to run childcare for their own teachers as well as for the people in the community. So now think about this. Oh, I forgot to tell you, this whole campus is off the grid. They produce their own energy. Okay, so now, right? So if you're the state person watching this, you're like, well, what do you need from us? And so far they're saying, well, we'd like you to pat us on the back, but right now we don't need energy money, right? Construction money they don't need because the guy who owns the property, he says, I'm going to build because I want it to conform to the rest of the campus, so I'm going to build, but you're going to pay me rent. Well, where are we going to get that rent money? Oh, well, they're actually going to work because they've got these businesses they're going to develop, and we still haven't asked the government to help us out yet. And we'll get back to you. We want you to know about this, but we'll get back to you when we need you, kind of a thing. Okay? That's what's going on out there. So I know it's, again, a very long answer to short questions, but it's the sense that, you know, the reason I get, as you can see, slightly passionate about this, and why I really made this commitment to Texas is, of course, you know, Betty. And you we're watching you guys from the outside. I know all your statistics. Okay, I know exactly how many folks you've got living in state institutions. I know how much pressure you have on your budget issues. I know exactly. You know, we've been, you know, we're studying. We're not, even though this is my, second time in Austin, and I've been, actually was to Midland, Texas when I was 16 years old, but that's a whole other story. We do study you, and we are keeping an eye on you, and the reason for that is because we really, as you can see, we think we can come up with solutions. Go back to my first slide. We're investment bankers. What do investment bankers do? Yes, the guys on Wall Street make a lot of money. We don't make a lot of money, but what we do is solve problems. I mean, that's all we're doing. So we want you to know that this is another resource at your fingertips, so that when you're trying to solve this, I don't understand the politics down here. I'm not going to try to. I'm not going to do your job. I'm not trying to take over. But as you're struggling to go through what's going to happen over the next year, 2 years, 5 years, just know that, wow, there's this other resource we can tap into. We're not being Pollyannish, and we're not saying we have the pixie dust and it's all going to be better tomorrow. What we can tell you is there's a lot of good stuff going on around the country. We happen to have a seat at the table on a lot of it. We keep learning every day. People come to us every single day with a new model. Alfreda, Georgia, that thing came to us 3 weeks ago. And I'm already looking. We're not going to invest in that because we don't do private equity, but I'm already hooking those guys up with a private equity guy who does real estate and would love that kind of thing, because the IRR on that kind of an investment is going to be a nice return. So great, go. Marry two people and let them become a couple and go and do that thing. So we can do those things for you guys. And again, I really can't tell you what this means to us to have been invited down. We're just here. We're here for you, and please don't hesitate.
Are you looking to drum up business in Texas? I mean, how are you going to approach that? Are you looking? I as a state employee can't go out and say, I think I've got an investment banker for you. And the reason I ask that is I'm assuming maybe it's through the Federal Home Loan Bank when you come out here, and word will get around. The reason I ask is we started a program in 2008 for anybody that wanted to voluntarily close their ICFMRs. We would provide financial incentives, and we closed 700 beds in 2 years. Now, only half of those beds were occupied, which is
right.
Their updated models of providing care, but they were going into HCS residential, single-family homes, and it sounds just like what you're talking about, mm-hmm. that niche market there.
Yeah, and again, it's a good question.
Some of them had some finance, as you can imagine, had some financing problems.
But that's where it collapsed. Right, and that's where, again, we're not, unlike a business that says, Betty can chime in, but we don't go to our board and say, here's our growth model, and I don't get bonuses if we do X amount. We're here to solve problems. We could go a whole year and not do one loan, and we'll be very successful because I know we'll be solving other problems. So it's not about when you say drumming up business. It's the reverse of if you are trying to solve a problem, if there are no problems, let's say it's the reverse, right? Let's say it's Utopia, USA, okay? Or maybe there's one area in Texas that's absolutely perfect, right? Well, we're not going in to try to fix something that's not broke, right? We're not forcing us. What we want to be able to do is say, look, if you're trying to solve this issue and you're running into a problem and there's a logjam, maybe the logjam is just the communication. Maybe it is two parties that are there wanting to do it. You're the state agency. You have the person who wants to do the right thing, and there's a logjam either on execution, they don't know how to do it, finance. Then it's being, what's that guy's name, Charlie? Oh, yeah, why don't you call him, right? We're not making any guarantees, and that's you deal with him. But see, and that gives you just that extra thing rather than saying, oh, all's lost. We can't get this done. And that's all. And what you are going to do is you're going to start running into more and more, especially for your agency to start looking at the autism advocacy groups. You're not going to be able to, you don't have enough money to handle all those. It's literally a tsunami that's about to hit. That's where I really suggest you start telling them, and we are having meetings with parent groups. It is so fascinating. You have parents coming to us, kids are 8, 10, 12. They're not looking for housing next year. They're already planning 9 years in advance. That's what, so But that's the point. So from your standpoint, you already know, right? If you were to go to the state ed department, you would know exactly who's coming up the ranks, right? And what you want to do is cut that off at the pass and say, hey, you guys should better start planning. Do not show up at my doorstep at age 19, 20, 21 and expect me to call them and say, how many vouchers do you have and get me housing? No, that's not planning. And that's what we're really trying to teach parents. We're very sensitive. See, I'm on your side of the table. We're very sensitive to what you're going through. So we're very harsh with the parents, whereas, you know, to say plan, plan, plan. You can't keep looking at the government and think they're going to solve all your problems because, it's not one, it's not fair, and, two, there isn't going to be enough money. No way, no how. So I just think it's that sense of, again, time, discussion. It's just so we're not here to drum up business. And it's very funny you said that because we, in our first meeting, one of the first meetings we had with the state agency in New York, the head of the agency, who's a friend of mine because of this process, right, and we really have had nice dialogue, got four of his lieutenants. They break the state up in New York into 13 districts, so he had four of the 13 volunteer to be the guinea pigs, right, of who's going to work with Charlie, you know. Someone's got to start this process. And they were on a video conference, and one was in the room. And somebody on the video conference said, well, why are you creating all this demand? So I looked at his boss, who was sitting across from me, like, you want to answer that, or do I want to? I mean, and he answered, like, he saw the smirk on my face. He goes, I got this one. He goes, idiot, he's not creating the demand. You know, we have the demand. It's just that we can't handle it. And you think about it as a factory. You know, it's that old Lucy episode, right? I mean, the belt is going down, and it's one chocolate, and it's two chocolates, and then next thing you know, she's shoving her mouth. Well, you guys have one family, and now it's 10 families, now it's 100, and you just can't keep up with it. So what we're trying to do is saying, look, we're not creating this demand. They're flowing over the sides of the conveyor belt because they have nowhere else to talk to and go. And one hears from the other, hears from the other, that we got this guy, Charlie, and he's willing to take your phone call. Well, of course they're going to call. They just want a, you know, a shoulder to cry on. But then we formulate this into real plans. This is really, okay, so how do we do this? So I think it's more of a sense that it's natural. And I really think our next drumming up of business, as I explained, in 2011, what we hope to do in Texas is two simple things. We're going to close a house. Right, so we're going to do a loan. We already know, you know, where that's going to be, and we're going to get that done. Why? Because then I want it on our portfolio, so our money, you know, talks as well. Not, you know, this isn't just talk. Then I can come back to you guys and say, oh, look what we did here. It's integrated. It's in the community. We did it. We provide the financing, and, you know, we hope you'll see that we can actually do it. And the second thing is what I explained. We are really, for me, to be successful here and to help you guys be successful is to try to get this Fed meeting going, because until you get the banks and you get the mainstream finance to the table, this is always going to be a, what's the state going to pay for? And you can't do that anymore. I mean, you just can't.
And I think that also, I mean, part of this, the reason why we have this meeting is for those who are the state agency representatives here to say, you know, who are your subrecipients that, you know, need this connection, need to, you know, have one piece of the puzzle and need to put those other pieces together. You know, who are the people who need to come to this meeting in 2011 with the Federal Reserve Bank, but also with housing developers and service providers and government agencies, and as well as, you know, for those who are our governor appointees, you may be that organization that needs to come to the table because you need those other pieces there, and so you have the unique perspective that you have a development that you're wanting to, you know, make happen, or you have the people who need to find that home, and how do we put those, you know, all those people at the table? So I think that that's one of the main reasons why we wanted to make sure that people gave some feedback to Charles today about, you know, who are those groups that we want to make sure we invite, and also to be maybe part of the process of helping him put that together. So, you know, inviting them ourselves, saying, you know, you're our subrecipients and you may be interested in this.
So process-wise, what we're going to do today was the first step to make sure speak now, forever hold your peace kind of a thing. I mean, if you think this is not a good idea, which is fine, we're more than happy to hear that, then tell me. But if you think this is a good idea, then what I'm going to do is aggressively in January get the dialogue going with Dallas to commit to a date in to do it here in Austin in 2011. Once I get that commitment from them, I will come back to Ashley, to come back to all of you, and do that second piece that Ashley just mentioned. Okay, we're locked into a date. I'll deal with the agenda and the format, so to speak. So again, you guys start making up your invitation list. Who should be there? What are we trying to accomplish? What does an agenda look like? And again, how do we make this productive so it's not just talk, 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 it's another conference, and everyone gets to say, oh, we had another conference. But no, what are we going to try to accomplish there? And then we'll actually go ahead and execute it. Yes, please.
Being with the Texas Department of Agriculture, housing, disability services, that's not an area that we really delve into very much. But I'm really starting to see that there might be a whole other twist to this. You know, 80% of Texas is rural. Not the majority of the population doesn't live in these rural towns, but there is a lot of, you know, rural area to cover. It doesn't sound like you're working a lot in rural areas, but have you considered this as a potential economic development tool that might be available, you know, that could start working in rural areas where there are families, there are kids, you know, they're not really getting a service, quality of service that they might be able to get, but, you know, having this type of property could develop jobs, could, you know,
yep,
entice professionals.
I can't even pay you guys to ask such good questions.
I have to take
please.
Very nice to meet you, actually.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. I'm telling you, this is like segue into excellent questions into, you know, great things. So let's talk about rural areas on a couple of different levels. In October of 2009, for the state of New York, I was the keynote speaker on the housing conference for developmental disabilities, and at the time, the woman who ran the USDA program on disabilities, who's got a lot of money, big budget, and no one's using it, came up, heard about this, came from Washington to basically say, I've got money and no one's using it because of exactly what you said, which is no one's making that connection between rural and disability. So the answer is, yes, we have been keyed into this ever since I heard her, because I didn't even know the USDA was making some net. There was actually an office in the USDA that focused on disabilities. So now let's bring that forward. What we, again, I've got a lot of models and a lot of things that have been discussed. What is coming to us over and over and over again from parent groups is the working farm. Again, built in, ooh, we got housing and a job, and it can sustain itself. So we are getting a lot of those models to us, and we are, so the Brattleboro, Vermont would be the first, what I would consider rural, meaning outside of your typical suburbia kind of thing, or urban. The true rural of what you're talking about, on two levels, we are going to see a lot more of that in the near future. On one level, it is parent groups that are coming to us and saying they've got their own models to buy some land, it's the working farm, we're going to do organic food, and we're going to sell it to the community, and they'll, you know, so that is happening. The second is that as an offshoot on Autism Speaks, there is actually an alliance from across the country on agricultural businesses who are starting to look at the business and employing kids with young adults with autism in there, and I can get you those contacts if you'd like to start getting involved in that dialogue with them, because they're a national organization. The gentleman who I met, I think, is out of Chicago, but it's basically that they're working nationally. My point on all that is I think that is sort of you're capturing what is going to be the wave of the future. Very interestingly, when we had the immigrant issue back in New York, and of course in New York on Long Island, not New York City, but on Long Island, you have the wineries and the farms, and there was a lot of moaning and groaning about, well, the crackdown on the immigration is you're losing the labor force, you know, at these farms. And the disability community came in and said, hello, you know, we're sorry about the immigration issue, we're not getting involved with that, but we got pretty sturdy, you know, young men who would love to work in the farms because nobody else is giving them a job to do, and they happen to have autism, but they physically can, you know, handle, you know, whatever they need to do. So I think it's really not that no one's thought about it before. I just think it's, you're hitting on something that's a wave of the future. I would very much suggest that you are part of this dialogue because it becomes another solution and it becomes another wave. Now, in terms of your other part of your question, which is, okay, now how do you deliver services, you know, to folks who will need it? Look, I think that, again, it's one of those problems. How do you solve that problem? In the case of what's going to happen in this Brattleboro, Vermont situation, how are they getting all of the, you know, it's nice to say, oh, we're going to start a school. Well, you need someone to teach these kids. And autism is not, you know, pens, pencils, and you got a school. I mean, you need trained, you know, folks. Well, they have been importing talent, and to import that talent, they, the school has said, well, we've been setting up, you know, cheaper housing for you, and we're going to have child care for you, and they're trying to make it as comfortable as possible. So it becomes a little more holistic, not just for the person who needs it, but really for the whole support. What we have been finding, and this was a very good question on the integrated situation, you know, we're finding situations where, let's say New York, and I'm sure you have places, you know, here in Texas, it's very expensive to live in a New York City, Manhattan, for instance. So it's really great if you're going to say, well, we're going to set up this whole thing for people with disabilities in the city of New York. If the workforce has to travel an hour and a half by commuting because they can't afford to live there. So again, what are the models that are coming up? Models are coming up is you get the two-family house. Well, on one side of the house is the person with the disability. The other side of the house is the caretaker, and you're giving them free rent to be able to live there because then that way there's no commute, right? It's separate so they can feel like they have their own life. But at the same time, they have no commute. They can literally be there, and it's affordable. Again, it's not Pollyannish, and it's not trying to say, here's the model, stamp it and cookie cutter, and you'll have it. But each of these, you know, you have different jurisdictions, idiosyncrasies in the state. And I just think it's, one, you're presenting a good alternative solution. And, of course, there will be some issues that come up with those, but I think it's, you know, something that can be addressed.
Well, I think just having sat in on the rural
housing
that, you know, TxDOT, Department of Transportation here in Texas, has some programs out that they're trying to fund very innovative projects, and this is something that maybe those guys should be invited to the 2011 meeting because transportation is a big issue when it
sure.
comes to serving rural Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So that was exciting sitting in on that and hearing about all that they're trying to do in tying housing and services and all that together. So.
No, I think that would be great, and that's why I say if we can, it sounds like I've got the green light from you guys to go ahead and try to get the Fed involved. So if we get them to commit to a date, we'll come back to you, and you guys, you know, the invitation, this is not a closed story, so we open it up and tell us who you think should be at the table, and then we'll create the agenda around that. Yes?
Let me ask you for another segue.
Sure.
And that is, my agency deals with a population that lots of people don't basically like to deal with, individuals with
mental illness,
mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Substance abuse,
mm-hmm.
people with AIDS, and I just want to hear your thoughts about how that works with this, because most of what you talked about, you know,
right, and again, I don't want to, right, and I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I got an answer for everything, but unfortunately, you guys have asked every good question that I happen to have an answer for. Hour-long policies do not limit us to a specific disability. That was the whole point of creating the Disability Opportunity Fund. So that loan I told you about that got repaid very quickly, that actually was to a project out in California for strictly for people with mental illness. So we do that lending. Obviously, on the policy side, though, as you can hear how passionate I am about it, it's not I'm this passionate about that issue, but as you well know, and you teach me the world of mental illness, especially substance abuse, and I'm not creating anything new there. That stuff has been done. What you're struggling with, of course, is how we're paying for whatever we need. So we sort of break it into the two bundles, which is on the financing side, you can give me anything you want and refer anything you want to me that you need, and we will do that financing, and if we can't do it, we'll find it. We've done substance abuse. We have not done AIDS, but we've done substance abuse. We have done mental illness, as well as the examples I've given you. So that doesn't scare us at all. On the policy side, I will never be brazen enough to say I'm going to start teaching you something that you guys have been working on for decades. We have been brought in, especially in New York City. They are trying to get away from the SRO models. Remember, these are policy issues you guys have to deal with because I don't know what's good for people with mental illness or not. I've learned it, but I'm really going to rely on the experts to tell me what the new trends are. So we've had New York City come to us and say, we've got guys living in SROs. They've been there for a long time. They're ready to graduate, but the state or the city mental health agency won't pay for anything but SROs. So that's where we may come in on a policy, say, hey, let's try something once or whatever. So sympathy is with you in terms of I totally know where you are. Remember in New York State, we have the three agencies, OASIS, OMH, and OMR, which is now OPWDD. So we're not only dealing with OPW because we don't like the other two agencies. OMH, New York, Office of Mental Health, has worked with our state finance agency, Sony May, decades ago in being the most creative on financing. I mean, issuing bonds, doing a whole bunch of things. I actually had the Housing Finance Authority come to me and say, don't worry about OMH, we have a great relationship with them. Could you bring this gorilla in the room and bring them to the, this is one state agency asking me to bring another state agency to the table, okay?
We may ask you for that.
You don't scare me. But seriously, I just look at OMH, anything in mental health, any on substance abuse, it's just I'm never going to be the expert, and I don't want to be the expert because I think the policy stuff you've got down pat. The finance side will do whatever you want because we have – why did we do the loan in California? Because the model is exactly the same as the other. As long as there was some debt service on the back end, then we knew. Now, fascinating in that case, the debt service was simple because there were so many programs – on the financing side for low-income housing tax credit and stuff for mental illness, for homelessness, disabled vets, whatever it was, that doing those deals, man, they're the easiest deals to do because we always know that there's going to be money flowing. I think what you're going to struggle with, of course, is not the policy issue but more along the lines of where the resource is going to come from. Absolutely feel free because we are definitely involved in that.
Thank you.
Anybody on the phone still? Any questions, thoughts?
Present, but no questions.
Good. All right. Well, I'm going to say it again. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. No? My pleasure. This is great. And thank you for the weather. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little better than New York.
Great.
And I don't want anyone here rooting for the Phillies next year. The next 5 years.
So I'll definitely...
And have a good... anyone on the phone also, please have a wonderful holiday. Happy New Year.
Yeah, and I'll definitely make sure that I send out whatever communication that I get from Charles for the 2011 meeting and make sure I get your input to And yeah, I'm actually, we're really relying on everyone, all the council's input on people that
thank
they
you.
Want.
I'm sorry to have had my back.
Well, I had already thought of a few organizations or heads that would want to come.
Good.
Nonprofits.
Good.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Private Providers Association, you know, because I rep all different constituencies.
We have some large providers that we've been talking about, you know, who like, we're getting some sustainable income levels, and then we've got some of our larger community rehab providers that would be great people to bring in because they could add that element to it. So.
Great.
Yeah, definitely.
And what we've also been doing with some of the larger providers is we for those who've established, been around for a while, we actually have been lending on the balance sheet because it makes it, you know, again, bank won't do that. We'll do that. I mean, basically, it's a handshake. Yeah, I mean, trust me, it's documented up the wazoo, but it really is. We're saying, look, we know you're not going out of business, and we know you're not running away in the middle of the night.
Right.
So if you're going to try to do something new, you're trying to stretch your dollars, we come in and we say, all right, we'll give you that, you know, hand until. So if you had, let's assume you had a situation where you needed a bridge because you knew that you wanted to get a program going, but you know it's never going to get into the 11 budget. Maybe you won't even get into the 12 budget, but you think you're going to push for it in, like, you know, 12 to 13 budget, something like that. Fine. We'll come in for the 2-3 years on the hope that it's going to get paid out, you know, down the line. So, we could, again, creativity is the most important thing, and what, making you guys happy is the important thing. That's the important aspect to it.
I would say, you know, if you have contacts at USDA, they have Texas people in that
right.
division, that would be excellent to invite. Unfortunately, at the Texas Department of Agriculture, this isn't, again, this isn't an area where we have that type of contact.
No, that's fine. And it's all new. It's all new. And I will tell you, the 40 that I told you about, the 40 CDFIs in this state, you know, that's, because remember, we're not trying to be dogmatic about this, saying, oh, it has to be our deal. The whole idea was to go out there and sort of, you know, proselytize about this so that we can get the 40 CDFIs you have here. We want them to work with you on the ground.
And I, looked at, them in their funding allocations from the feds. It was a pretty diverse group.
Sure, yep. Absolutely. And who mentioned the Federal Home Loan Bank before? Somebody mentioned it. See, you know, because they're very progressive in terms of the money that they that flows through them. And they,
I love them. I mean, they use the match home.
Yeah. They're very, very progressive. Very, very progressive. So, and we use the Fed as sort of our launching pad for the discussions. And it, yes, it would be very nice to go get some TARP money just for us. You know, to give to you guys rather than for all the craziness they've been spending on. But the Federal Home Loan Bank is really the progressive one, and that's good. So.
Well, I know that you probably had an opportunity to talk to THCA probably more extensively than us, but we are a 501c3 nonprofit that serves the entire state, and we're actually in the process of going through the CDFI application, not for TSHAC, but with a partner 501c3. And so we have a lot of more flexibility in our funding, and it's not federal in nature, and we have, and one thing that we try to do that when we try to do smaller projects,
mm-hmm.
We can be more flexible with our funds. So I would just like to be able to have an opportunity to talk with you guys.
Absolutely.
Just so you know what we have to offer. So if you do get a call from someone saying, hey, I'm trying to do this in Texas, maybe we can partner.
Absolutely. Oh, I had no idea, and I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to know that because that's what we're looking for. What we're looking for is that partner in the state that we can say, okay, you know, so we don't, as much as I love JetBlue, I don't need to fly down here every 2 minutes if you're my Texas office. I mean, that would be fantastic. I would love to. Now, I don't know, does everyone have all my contact? I mean, I brought some cards, so if anyone wants
that's
to take, okay. Take these, and then if you want, please write down what I want you to do, because they're not on my card, is write down my cell phone number, because that I have with me 24/7.
So everyone has
it. I'm give you, this is David Dannenfels, the okay. individual that was sitting next to me, and
yeah.
that's mine.
Great. So for those on the phone, I'm just going to, Ashley, I'm sure will email you the rest of my contact, but my cell phone is 516-361-3600. And if I do not answer, that means that my kids took it away from me because I'm addicted to it. But seriously, if you really need to get me and don't get me through, I mean, obviously I get emails all the time, and the office, though, is because I'm traveling so much, is more hit or miss. So don't feel shy, and if it does go to voicemail, I will get back to you relatively quickly. But really, thank you very much, and you guys should enjoy your holidays and have a happy new year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.